Okay. Watch your mind.
Seems weird, doesn't it? The breath seems easier, doesn't it? The mind seems very curious.
But that's our job every day, you know? So you practice watching your breath, and then you train yourself, and then eventually you don't watch your breath while you're driving, you're watching your mind, dear. Not the car in front of you, you're watching him too, but you're seeing what's arising in your mind, and that's the skill we simply learn. This is the most basic skill we need to learn from doing our single point of concentration meditation, okay? Is to start to become conscious of what the hell is going on inside your head, rather than just being this victim to circumstances, which is how we live our lives, you know? So it's a practical skill, and it's amazing. Once we start this, then, you know, you're really on track. So here, what we're just doing for a few minutes is seeing the thoughts come and seeing the thoughts go, you know. And there's all sorts of benefit from this doing this kind of meditation. One of them is you get to see they're just thoughts. They're just thoughts. They're just thoughts. They're all just thoughts. And as I said before, the Buddhist approach, we have to start to distinguish between the thoughts that are valid, which means they have a basis in reality, and the thoughts that aren't valid. Which is a big surprise to us, because we have a very deep view that if it's in my mind, it must be valid. If I think it, it must be real. We think this with an absolute certainty, you know. This is like completely nihilistic. Fascist, in fact. Shocking, actually. We reify thoughts, you know. Whatever rises in my mind, we think there's something special because it's my thoughts. It's just beyond bizarre. We have to learn to distinguish what's inside the mind and distinguish between virtuous and non-virtuous, valid and invalid. This sounds simple, but it's the trickiest job we'll ever do. It takes a lot of time, you know. And of course, we're using here Buddha's view of the mind, not Jung's, not Freud's, not our own. We're using Buddha's view, if we so choose. And he's got very specific definitions, very specific views about what goes on in the mind. So that's up to us. Okay, so we still have Tara there. We'll leave her there for now. We'll finish the meditation with the final part later. So I wonder if there are any questions you had from your debates and discussions over lunch about emptiness, for example, about the self, or about anything else. We can say some more about dependent arising and emptiness, but we'll also talk about bodhicitta and how to cultivate that. Yesterday mostly it was renunciation, the delusions and karma. Beginning today a bit about emptiness, and then bodhicitta to discuss, which is the crucial prerequisite, the one that drives the bodhisattvas to never give up working on their minds, becoming a Buddha for the sake of sentient beings. So we'll describe that one. And then finish with the meditation later. So are there any questions about anything in general? Karma, the delusions, the mind, dependent arising, self, emptiness, what exists, what doesn't exist?
Yeah, I got a question.
Okay, where's the mic? Give the man the mic.
Yeah.
Where is he?
I got the mic.
Lawrence again. Yeah, that's right. Good talking to you, Lawrence.
Yeah.
Lawrence, isn't it? Lawrence.
Yeah.
Okay, go.
We're focusing on reality, huh? We're trying to see reality always as it is. And there's one thing I wonder is about it's basically the life force. I would just...
The what, darling?
Life force.
Life force. What would there's you define as your life force?
One thing is mysterious to me.
What?
One thing is mysterious to me.
Yeah.
That everything's always going positively towards life. So there's no flower which has the right conditions, which just decides like...
There's no flower
no.
But what?
There's no flower like in the world which has the right conditions around it, which says like, oh no, I don't want to grow. I just leave it. So there's obviously like a life force in everywhere.
Well, you say obviously, but you didn't convince me.
I mean, why is everything growing?
Well, what's the question then? What's the question?
I'm coming into this life,
good.
And
yeah.
I also want to live, kind of, okay. Right?
So the question is, what drives you?
So the question is, this is a little bit of a fact to me. I mean, it's obvious that
it's
everything...
It's the same question. It's, no. It's her question.
Yeah.
Same. What drives the mind? So first we have to establish this mind. Forget the flowers for the moment. We'll go into this. But let's look at Lawrence. And we all know, don't we, whatever we define as the mind, but we know the difference between a dead Lawrence and a live Lawrence is there's movement there, and you don't stink, and you don't rot. So clearly there's no life force once Lawrence's body is rotting, once the mind has gone. The Buddha would say it's your mind that's gone. So obviously what causes your mind to, you know, to move here and walk there and think that and do this is what causes your body to do those things is the presence of your mind in your body. So obviously what drives your body is your mind, isn't it? Your thoughts basically. Would you agree with that? Well, that's another way of saying karma. Because what your mind does from moment to moment is what Buddha means by the law of karma. What your mind does is what propels your mind, propels you from moment to moment and life to life. What propels the lion to go off and stalk the buffalo, we can give this interpretation that she has to feed her babies, but that's intellectual. What drives her instinctively, the life force in the lion, is this instinct from habit of attachment to get what she wants, and then aggression because she's hungry, and to feed her babies, that's there too. The aggression she uses to rip the guts out of the buffalo for breakfast. She's driven by her past intentions, past practice. That's the life force. Mind is the life force. Now, okay, flowers don't have life force. Buddha would say flower is not a sentient being. It's the four elements. So finally, the Buddha's view, which is described very nicely in Tantra, the tantric model, and Lama Zopa said, in fact, when we looked at karma, remember Buddha's view of karma, there are four ways in which when I began to do this, I went off on a track this morning. If we look into our present life, you agree, don't you, that there is Lawrence, who's a human being. Then there's Lawrence's tendencies, yeah? Then there's Lawrence's experiences, the people and the animals, what they do to him, how they see him and how they treat him. Would you agree with that? And then the last one is the environment in which you live. It could be the house you live in, the country you live in, whether there are flowers or broken rocks or a war zone or a desert. That's environment. Would you agree? Yeah? Well, all of that, finally, for the Buddha's view, the creative process that causes you to have a human body, you to have good tendencies or bad ones, you to have rapists or murderers or lovers in front of you, and you to have a shitty environment or a beautiful one, the very way the elements manifest, the cause of all of this is your past actions. So in the Kala Chakra Tantra, as Rinpoche says, there are highly, you know, especially in the Tantras, which have this model of the four elements being the makeup of the physical universe. If we have the Christian teaching, God's the boss, isn't he? If we have the materialist one, we don't quite know what it is yet. They're just the elements. Then we have all this mysterious ones called, you know, we think this person called Mother Nature or something. Who knows what that means? The Buddha, the way the universe manifests in front of you, whether a flower wilts or dies, whether there's a rock or whether there's a war zone, whether there's terrorists or the environment, whether it's mouldy or beautiful or ugly or broken or, you know, or whatever. The way those elements manifest in those shapes and forms is the product over many, many lives of you and all the people who live in that environment. And so, as Lama Zopa put it in the Kala Chakra Tantra, you could say that in the mind, remember, your mind has this inextricable relationship with the four elements. We discussed this yesterday. You've got the gross consciousness coming along inextricably with your particular set of gross elements, which is your gross body, Lawrence's body. The lion has her mind and the lion's body, the claws, the hair and all the rest, you know. Then you've got subtle consciousness, which is what arises when you dream. We mostly don't know about that, or what occurs after you stop breathing when you look like you're dead. Your subtle consciousness is now there, and your subtle physical energies in this model, they describe that as the wind energies, the prana. And then you've got this subtle 72,000 channels, this subtle nervous system through which these wind energies go, and they are intimately connected to all the different states of mind, and they've all got this relationship with your wind energy. So you go to your Tibetan doctor, she'll feel your pulses and she'll know exactly which winds are in balance and which one's out, and it's quite subtle and the same as the Chinese, and then she'll relate that to the different states of mind, and she'll be able to see the link between those states of mind and those wind energies. So as Lama Zopa says, roughly, when your mind is deluded or polluted, that's negative, that pollutes your wind energies, which in turn manifests as your sickness now and in future lives, which in turn externally impacts upon the external elements, so causes the imbalance of the external elements. That's roughly Buddha's explanation of the universe. So the life force is mind. Consciousness, actions.
Without mind, there is no life force.
That's a really good point. You could say the elements are inert. They have no power to manifest as trees and flowers without their being minds. It's true. They're the product of the actions of minds. Finally, the big picture view, you know? How come even this universe came into place? It's the result of billions of lives ago that we all created the cause eventually to come and be reborn on this particular planet called Earth. It's the karmic result of our past actions from many lives ago. We're talking like eons of time, this process. There's no person up there pulling the strings, there's no boss, there's no God, and there's not a random event, and it's not merely the elements themselves that have no relationship with people, not like that. Sentient beings. Another way to put it, I find this interesting and helpful, Buddha would say there's not an atom of space where you won't find sentient beings. And then secondly, if you think the physical universe is made of the four elements and that every one of those minds has this natural relationship with their own set of the four elements, then you could argue that the entire universe is just the four elements and it's a conducive environment for minds to conjoin with them. So basically our mind is conjoined with this set of four elements, isn't it? It's the same elements as the rocks and the toilet, isn't it? Same elements. But we're so used to believing this is me with the five digits here and a couple of holes and a few lumps and bits and pieces, you know. But it's just the way our karma has created this shape. The same with the lizard and the fish and the dog. That is the physical elements created over, this is almost like karmic evolution, created over eons of time. How, you know, there's like you've got lizard shapes and how and dog shapes and lion shapes and human shapes. And depending on the karma, you run to that particular house and you become a human for a while. And all the previous humans have put it up, set it up very nicely for you by their human behaviour. You've got another karma, you go join the lion house, then you go join the lizard house or the ant house, sort of thing, my way of saying it. Buddha doesn't talk
about
it.
So like the positive growth or like the growth of...
What, sweetheart?
The growth of flowers is kind of like almost like something like a need of a karmic revolution or evolution or what?
Okay, if we call... Okay.
Evolution.
If we look at the outside world, we say, and we see our environment out there, and we, relatively speaking, given the laws of environments, and if London's not erupting in front of you every day as war and violence, and there's, well, sometimes there is, and the flowers grow when they should, and the rain comes when it should, and things are fairly peaceful, and the sky can look quite pretty some days, that's your karmic appearance. The things, the elements are behaving nicely. You can easily be born in a country, as we know, where you're stinking, where it's filthy and polluted and rocks and paranoia and terrorism and war. That's your karmic appearance. It's personal. They're real, there is war there. There's real, there is peace there. There is polluted water there. There is peace, sweet water there. This is just the elements manifesting according to the karma of the beings who are experiencing it. And by how we behave in that place, that's setting up the environment for the future in that place. For the future sentient beings who have the karma to have that kind of environment.
That's also a forest, no?
What, sweetheart?
Isn't this like also kind of like a forest which is before everything, that everything
I'm really
like,
going to catch you,
gets
Raj.
Created in this
Forgive
way?
Me, can you say all that again? I want to hear every word you say.
Yeah, I mean, if there must be some force which like puts it all together
okay,
like this, no?
Okay, that's the Christian teaching. So if you feel that, you've got a Christian tendency, and that's okay. You're allowed to, but Buddha would disagree. This is an unnecessary embellishment. We don't need a boss. It doesn't need a thing to hold it together. Like the Buddha's view is, we don't need a little self-existent Lawrence in there who runs the show and who makes the anger work and makes the jealousy work and makes the fingers work. Don't need it, baby. They work nicely on their own. You don't need a landlord. The universe doesn't need a person to hold it all together. Mental actions of sentient beings are what create the universes. They don't need a boss. This is the view of the eternalistic view, and this is the philosophy of self-existence. There's something up there pulling the strings, which is the view of God.
Cause
you might be right.
Is cause and effect not kind of a boss?
Cause and effect is the view of karma, yep.
Cause and effect is a boss, no?
Yeah, that's right, the law of karma. As Lama Yeshe says, you know, karma takes care. It's a natural process. Are we communicating?
Yep,
good.
We're communicating.
This is Buddha's view. You don't have to believe it, or like it, or even accept it. What else, people?
Yeah, I just wondered if you could... talk a little bit about the Buddhist explanation of what happens at the moment of death.
Okay, I can
this
do
sort
that.
Of, yes. You know, I guess we're talking about sort of when the mind leaves the
Precisely.
Body.
Precisely, yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Just, I just would like to understand that
Absolutely.
A little bit
Absolutely, it's a very good point, good one. Thank you, darling. Actually, it's a book I'm working on at the moment, you know, and I'm told it's a book by Lama Zopa Rinpoche of how to help people at the time of death. And so a section of it, of course, is what happens at the time of death. So in the sutra teachings, There are the descriptions of what they call the 12 links of dependent arising, this process of what keeps us locked into samsaric cycle of rebirth, you know? And there's four of those that play a crucial role at the time of death. Then you've got, in the tantric teachings, you've got this process of death that's based upon this model of consciousness, gross consciousness, subtle consciousness, very subtle consciousness, with the elements. And that's described in 8 stages, and that's the process which we can now talk about, okay? Okay. So this way of describing how a person, they talk about a process of dissolution or a process of absorption. It's sort of like the gradual deconstruction of the package called you, basically. That's what death is, you know? And it's described in quite great detail. And then the yogis in their meditation are able to replicate this so that when they do get to the time of death, they're really in charge of that process. They know exactly what's going on, and they can go through the process of going from gross to subtle to very subtle without losing consciousness. I mean, consciousness at a subtle level. And they're able to completely manipulate this process and get to the very subtle level, which is the most marvelous level of mind. As Lama Zopa said, it's the time the yogis have been waiting for. And they're able to then use that, because it's the most potent level of your consciousness, the most unencumbered, the most pure, the most powerful, and we go through this every time we die, and indeed we go through it every time we sleep, because the process of sleeping is the same physiologically and psychologically as this process of death, which is why the yogis use that process. So they're able to use that very subtle consciousness at the time of death to actually completely get beyond the delusions, realize emptiness, and even the greatest yogis become Buddha. So it's the most marvelous time, actually. So, okay, what happens at the time of death? Well, first of all, oh, hang on, my chair's falling apart. Just excuse me, everybody, just a moment. It's okay, it's all right, there we go. Thank you, sweetheart, thank you. There we go. Don't be sorry, it's me doing it. Okay, so what happens at the time of death? Roughly like this. It's okay, thanks, Eric. Excuse me. I have to confess that I'm late because I made a cafe latte. Excuse me. I carry a little 2-cup espresso around the world with me. And my nice medium roast Lavazza coffee. I only have one set of robes, but I have a coffee machine. Okay. I have to give it up at the time of death. Oh, my God. Okay, so the time of death, what happens is this. You know, it's usually this process, they don't say too much, but I've asked a lot of questions of different lamas, and it would seem this process is sort of, it begins a couple of hours before death, before you stop breathing, but it can be longer. But often it's said to be a few hours. And once it starts, it's like an inexorable process. It's rare to reverse it. So the first there are 8 stages, and at each of those stages, various things occur, okay? About 4 things occur at each stage. And like I said, it's really just the deconstruction of this person, you know? The bits and pieces of this person cease functioning. So, okay, the first thing, the first level, the first stage of these 8, there's at each stage of the first 4, there's a certain type of what they call a wisdom, which is a certain capacity of the mind. That ceases to function. There's a certain one of the elements ceases to function, and the sense consciousnesses ceases to function. And then fourth, there's a particular kind of subtle sign or indicator of this process that only really the yogis are familiar with, but which occurs every time we go through this process, including every time you go to sleep. So as you can see, when you go to sleep every night, you know, if you sleep well, one minute you're awake and next minute you wake up 8 hours later, isn't it? You know, you don't to be conscious of the process would seem almost impossible. It just sort of happens, you know. But this is what the yogis are learning to do. We need to practice this when we do these types of meditations like Tara. There are methods. You know, when we did it, we haven't done it yet, but we'll do it at the end of the day, where you bring the Tara into you and then you dissolve. Well, there's a whole way you do it in these practices where you replicate the process of death. And you imagine dissolving into emptiness and these things. It's a really good practice for being ready for death. Okay. So the first stage, what they call the wisdom, is the ability of your mind to hold a lot of information all at once, and that's very clear. We can do that. When you're wide awake, you can see many things and hold a lot of information. Now, you look at this process as something we do go through every time we sleep, and you'll see what I'm saying. Let's say I'm talking to you, and I'm really tired, and I'm struggling to keep awake, aren't we? It's a very powerful process that drives you inwards to sleep, isn't it? It's struggle to stay conscious. So you can see your mind is already diminishing, isn't it? You can't keep much information. You can't see many things. It's very limited. Well, that's what's occurring here. This wisdom, I forget what they call it, it's a type of a capacity of your mind to hold a lot of information all at once is ceasing to function. At the same time, your earth element is ceasing to function, which enables you to have a strong body. So what happens is the body becomes very weak and you become very, you know, drained and exhausted. Look, when you're tired, your body feels like lead, doesn't it? Doesn't it? Really hard, you know? So your body, your earth element ceases. You move your body less, you know? It's hard to move your body when you're tired, isn't it? You look. Then, at the same time, the eye consciousness, the capacity of your eyes to cognize, gradually ceases to function. And at the same time, there's this, what they call this subtle inner sign, and they call it like a mirage. Yogis can see this. It happens every time, but we don't notice it. It's quite subtle. And this is a good for people to get practice imagining this, so then you get to know the stages you're at during this process. So this has got relationship to the senses, to the elements, okay? Because if the earth element has ceased to function, this now makes uppermost the water element, doesn't it? The next one. So what is a mirage? You think about it. The interplay of earth and water, isn't it? So this is related just to the natural physiological thing that occurs based upon the view of elements, okay? There's this feeling of an inner side of a mirage. This leads naturally to the next stage where now the capacity of the mind to discriminate between pleasure, pain, and indifference. And this is most interesting because when they talk in Buddhist psychology, there's a grouping of states of mind called the always present states of mind. Each has its own particular function. And one of those is called feeling, not in the way we use it like emotion, but in a day, we only have any of these three. There's either a pleasant feeling, which is what we call happiness. There's either an unpleasant feeling, which is what we call suffering, or one that's neither of those, an indifferent one. And so this capacity, this ability to distinguish between these three sort of merges and this no longer arises. And if you sort of think about when you're really tired, who cares, you know? Pleasure, pain, indifference, you just want to sink into this oblivion, you know? Well, this is arising here. And so the water element ceases to function, second one. The liquids in your body begin to dry up. Your eyes, you know, the liquid, the blood, all the rest begin to dry up. And the ear consciousness ceases to function. And you look at this one. I'm sitting there talking to you, struggling to keep my eyes open, struggling to pretend I'm listening, and for the last 15 seconds I lost completely what you said. We had that experience? Because your ear consciousness withdrew. This is what happens. It's death. So now you can't hear, you know? Your ear consciousness ceases. Then, at the same time, there's this inner sign of, now this is the interplay, if you think about it, of the water element now giving rise to the prevalence of the fire element. And so, you know, they call it, this one is like smoky. And I don't know, I mean, if you think of interplay of fire and water and fire, it's like steamy, really, isn't it? But they call it smoke, you know, smoky. Then, naturally leading to the next stage, is this capacity to distinguish between friends, enemies, and strangers. So your beloved might be on this side of the bed and your most ugly, you know, ex-husband over here, if he cares to come and see you die, I don't know. The person you hated, your best friend and your worst enemy, and you've lost the plot, baby, you can't tell the difference. Forget it, you know. The distinguishing between friend, enemy, and stranger is gone. So what's happening is your mind is ceasing, getting smaller, smaller. All the bits and pieces aren't working so well. The body is deconstructing, ceasing to function. Then the inner sign here, they say it's like sparks. Sparks on a dark night of fire or fireflies. And again, you think interplay of fire and air, sparks, you know. So now what's the, you know, now with the fourth stage of death, the capacity now to even remember who you are. You know how we have this vivid sense of who I am in the world? I'm a Rabina, I'm a Buddhist nun, I'm Australian, I'm this, I'm old, I'm that, I do this, I'm this, I've got angry, I'm something. But this big picture, the music I like, Miles Davis, you know, Billy Strayhorn, Duke Ellington, Bach, you got this big view of who you are, isn't it? Where you fit in the world. Enemies, friends, strangers, they hate me, they love me. This whole vivid view of a conventional sense of I and where you fit in the world. This is gone. You've lost the plot. You haven't got a clue. No idea. This is gone. This wisdom, gone, finished. And the purpose of life, no idea. The tactile and the tongue consciousness cease. This tongue, they say, gets very short and turns blue at the root. And I always remember, as Geshe Rabchen said, one of my lamas, Zamazopa lamas, as he said, that tongue that has spent its life gossiping is now useless. I'll never forget that. I love that one. That's your tongue, your tactile. Then the air element ceases. The breath goes out and doesn't any longer come in. And then the inner sign is, they say it's like the last moment of a candle. You know how when a candle suddenly flares up before it goes out and then dies? And they say, Lama Zopa says, it's more like the light around the candle, this sign. And these are sort of indicators, if you're good enough, can do it, know the stages you're at, you know? So by this point, you're ready for the body bag in our culture. You're ready for the, you know, ready for the fridge. But the Buddha says you're not, or this view says you're not dead yet, okay? Now, before we get to the breathing, let's go back a step. There's lots of things that happen here, and this is the most crucial time before you stop breathing. In this period when it starts before you stop breathing, this is the most crucial time. This is like passing all tests of all exams. This is where you win the lottery or you go to hell, you know, one or the other. So, okay, so now we put that model aside for a moment, and we take the other model, the other one which they teach in the sutras, which is the 12 links of dependent arising. So there's certain of those that play a major role at the time of death. So the eighth and ninth ones are called craving and grasping. And all they are another words for attachment, which is the motor that drives us moment by moment to do whatever we do, you know? And so this, often they translate these words in a different way, but these are the words here. And all they are particularly powerful levels of attachment that function in particular at the time of death, play a very particular vital role at the time of death. So in normal life, craving is when it arises in your mind, you want something. And if you're observing your mind, you know, you see the thought is arising, oh, I really like a cup of coffee, like me after I had my lunch, you know. I thought, cafe latte. Then I looked at the clock. I thought, oh, God, I'll be late. I thought, I'll be quick, you know. And then I put the milk in, and then I forgot to put the coffee on, so I had to wait longer. So when I said to Erica, come and tell you what to do, you know. I'm so sorry, forgive me. So anyway, so the thought arose, I want a cup of coffee, a cafe latte. And then that's the craving arising. And then what happens is grasping takes over and it makes you go and do it. You know when you're really attached to something and you don't want to do it? You say, I want a piece of cake, and you're struggling. Before you know it, the cake's in the mouth. Because the next level of grasping, it won the show, didn't it? And it usually does. It makes you get what attachment wants. So at the time of death, these are really incredibly important. And these are happening before even the third stage, is what I've deduced from studying and looking, asking many lamas. Because also at this time, before the ability to discriminate, before you've lost the plot completely, is about the third stage. This is where you can't, they say at this time, they say in the Lamrim teachings, they say you've got to be, at that time, you've got to have virtuous thoughts in your mind, which means your mind has to be peaceful. Because there's this natural organic relationship, and we can look at this logically in our own life, between a peaceful mind and a virtuous mind, or a happy mind and a virtuous mind. So think of happy here, not in the way we think of hyperventilating, excited happy, like attachment happy, but happy meaning peaceful happy, joyful, content. That's happy mind. That's a real happy mind. And that, we know, does not arise when there's attachment, anger, fear, and all the rest. It's the opposite. We know this logically. So the Buddha's observation is pretty clear, is that when delusions are there, there's a lot of fear. You know, the craving is rising strongly at this point, craving to this life, this body, desperately. This attachment to this body is more than anything. That's why we've got to give it up in this life, because at the time of death, it's frantically clinging on to this body in this life, just spontaneously, if we've never practiced. It's natural. And this craving, the eighth link is so strong, you know, craving, not wanting to leave this life, not wanting to let go, not wanting to hold, you know, wanting to hold on. This is the craving. So this, of course, is very distressing for the mind. But if you've practiced, you've been a good Buddhist, you've thought about impermanence, you've got your practice, people are around you, they're playing the mantras, they've got your Lama's teachings on, you're seeing good things. It's all, this is why a conducive environment at the time of death is unbelievably important. You've got to set it up like a stage, because this person, this is their gig and they need to die well, and your job is the most important job, because the mind is so sensitive at the time of death and so freaked out and there's no awareness, and even if you're a practitioner, it's still scary. So you've got to provide this beautiful condition for the person, you know, to make it so conducive for them to have a peaceful mind. And then when they have a peaceful mind, this is the point, before even the third to the fourth stages, before you stop breathing, when the mind's still got, you know, can put two and two together, you can remind the person of their practice. You can play the, you know, the teachings, or say their practices to them, or talk about their Lama, or as Lama Zopa says, even before that, you talk about compassion, you talk about love, you even before this, before they die, you praise the person, you thank them for what they've done, you tell them they're a good person, you tell them they're virtuous, you tell them what a good mother they are. We even never think these thoughts, all we do is feel no bad thoughts. So you tell a person how good they are, how kind they are, they'll be blissful. It's so important. Helping them set it up to be ready to die with a peaceful mind. Then before they, this process, as it's arising, when the craving and the grasping are going to happen, before you stop breathing, before the, all the, you know, you lose the plot, then it's at this time you strongly help their mind be staying stable and peaceful. But nevertheless, the virtue has to be there, but at the same time, this craving and grasping will still happen. So during your life, you've got to have practiced the grasping. As Rinpoche is very clear, this grasping, when it comes after the attachment, after the craving, it has to be grasping for the next life. So if you're a Christian, this is perfect. You spent your life wanting to be in heaven with God. You'll die with a very peaceful mind, and the Buddha would suggest you go to the pure, you know, the blissful land, the God realms, a certain kind of birth, you know, God realms. So this is where you, this is, and this is the kind of person who would die with a happy mind. A person who's waiting to go to God dies with a happy mind if they really practice, you know. So their grasping goes to the, I want the next life. So this is practical. This is practical. For the Buddha, it's practical because your mind will continue, whether you like it or not. It's the way things are, he says. But you can be in charge of this process. So when the grasping arises, it will naturally, here we have to train it to be for the next life. And that means, in Buddhist terms, two options, a human rebirth, or they call it a pure land. And this is something a bit abstract for us. This is a type of rebirth, a subtle rebirth, where you're around the Buddhas and where you can receive teachings very easily and become enlightened very quickly. This is how they talk. You've got to look into this, you know. But at least another human rebirth. And you've got to not just think, oh, I'm going to die, I don't care what's going to happen, be passive, who cares. It's very practical. Buddha says your mind will continue, okay? He says it will continue, whether you like it or not. So you take that view. So then you might as well plan to do whatever's useful. I always remember when I was read about Steve Jobs dying and his sister who wrote a memorial sort of thing, and she was there at the time he died. And I can't remember the term she used, but it was very helpful. She said he was packed, ready to go. So all the time you think, oh God, prepare for death, prepare for death. Oh God, prepare for death, prepare for death. Or what's death? You know, a big black hole you've got to fall into. But actually, as a Buddhist, you're preparing for the next life, just like a Christian. Truly, no difference. The difference is a Christian is going to be with God. You've got, you know, and the Buddha, the very least, is another decent human rebirth, so you can keep on bopping, practicing your spiritual path. So it's a practical thing. Of course, materialists don't think this way. That's a different thing, you know. And many people think you just cross your fingers and hope for the best. Well, Buddha says, no, you're in charge, baby. You plan it. You organize it. You set it all up. You set your conditions. This is the approach to have, you know, as a Buddhist. So this grasping will anyway, as long as you're still a deluded being, you're going to have this grasping. So you've got to use it for at least clinging on to the, not clinging, but focusing on the next thing. And then along with that, before you stop breathing, while you've still got the plot there, you can hear the practices, remember your refuge, remember your practice, see the Tara, hear the teachings, and this, then what happens, and now this is the point, then what happens before you even stop breathing, this craving and grasping then lead to the 10th link, which they call becoming. And what this refers to is the ripening, all the conditions have come together now, and this is now going to ripen the number two link, which is called karma. And in your mind, basically, in this bank vault of yours, you've got trillions and trillions of karmic seeds, okay? And there, these are the complete karmic seeds. The complete karmic seeds that are the ones that, if they ripen, will throw you into the next rebirth. So at this time, when the craving and grasping arise and then becoming comes, this is all happening before you stop breathing, this will trigger if you've got a virtuous mind and you're focusing on the next life, this will trigger a virtuous karmic seed that will ripen, and then this will be the one that will determine your next decent human mummy or whatever. And then you eventually you stop, and you will die very peacefully. You can see, you'll be peaceful, you'll be happy, smiling. Then you stop breathing, and then we go to the next stages. But by this point, your next life's already determined. It's so important, this stage. So important. Okay? But you're not dead yet. But much of, you know, your next life's already determined. So if you die, they generally say that if you're dying, freaking out, grasping, panicking, seeing hallucinations of terrible things, this is a sign that already a negative karma's ripened, you know? Because negative, the mind being very fearful and deluded ripens a negative seed. It's just the way it is. No one's doing it. No one, like what Lawrence is saying, is up there running it all. We have an impulse very strong like that to think this. Buddha says no such thing. You don't need it. Karma takes care. It's a natural process. Deluded mind has a natural relationship with negative states of mind, negative karmic seeds, imprints, habits, seeds, whatever you want to call. So when the mind's peaceful, it'll ripen a virtuous seed. Then death will, and as they say, generally speaking, they say for people who die, when you die with negativity, which ripens negative karma before you stop breathing, it's like going from light to dark. It's like a nightmarish experience. And when you die with peaceful mind, virtuous mind, which ripens a virtuous karmic seed, which determines your next good birth, it's like going from dark into light. And so often you see people who die very blissfully. Steve Jobs, I'll never forget when I read about him, how he died. People say he was a Buddhist. I'm not sure. I read his biography and wasn't much about Buddha there. But he obviously knew he was dying and he prepared for it. And you can tell by how he talked, he was really on the case, you know. I love Steve Jobs, complete maniac, but I love this kind of mind he had. So he really looked into impermanence and death. You could tell he was ready for it. As she said, he was ready, packed, ready to go. And she got there, and this blew my mind, this. And he's lying there, skinny as a rake, because he had cancer, you know. And then he sat up somehow, and she was behind his two daughters, I think, two daughters. She was here. They were there facing Daddy, and she could see his face. And he's looking at them with a blissful face, loving, apologizing to his daughters for having to leave them. And then he looks into the distance over their shoulder, and he goes, "Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Oh, wow." And then he died. So I think we can deduce from this, I'm not sure, that he was seeing somehow, it was like a blissful experience. Because your mind, as you're dying anyway, is getting more subtle. You can have like clairvoyance at this point, because the grosser minds are ceasing and the subtler level of mind is becoming more prevalent. And your subtler level of mind, for the Buddha, this is no big deal, is clairvoyant, because the other grosser levels are not in the way. I remember when I was close to death one time, I was very sick in India, I had hepatitis and malaria together. I didn't know I was dying, I just felt terrible, you know. But Kirti Sensei Rinpoche said I was close to death. And I remember, like in this delusional state, hallucinating, I remember just thinking of a friend in England, and I knew what her, I was in Australia, oh, India, and I knew what her mind was thinking. So that's what your mind is capable of. And Buddha says we've had clairvoyance in countless lives. But we haven't used it enough and we've fallen down again. You know, we haven't used it to really grow, which means to realize emptiness. Because clairvoyance is a natural consequence of getting single-pointed concentration. It's just natural. We've accessed this subtle level of mind which necessarily can cognize phenomena that the gross mind can't. And this is, and as we're dying, the mind is getting more sensitive. The grosser level is ceasing. And so when you're freaking out at the time of death, it's because you're seeing the future coming, the nightmarish suffering rebirths, you know, the karmic appearances of suffering. If you're dying with peaceful mind, your mind is completely blissful. Just blissful. Nothing to be afraid of. There's nothing, there's no fear. It's blissful. Blissful. And then you stop breathing. Now, more process happens, and it could be 3 more days before your mind actually leaves the body. And they go in the teachings, they go through these stages of dissolution. We don't have to go all the way through, there's no need at the point. But there's various things that arise, all related to the components of the subtle body, the red and the white kundalini, the airs, all these different things occur, okay? But basically what occurs eventually when you get to the 8th of the 8 stages, everything keeps dissolving, ever more subtle, ever more subtle, ever more subtle, until you eventually get to what they call the very subtle consciousness and the very subtle wind energy, which is inextricably linked to. These are inextricably linked. And this is also called clear light mind. They even call it indestructible mind. This is the subtlest level of your conscious being, beyond which it can't be subtler, you know. So when this occurs, the great yogis who've been meditating through this process on emptiness, they are now, they can stay in their body for days, weeks, months, actually, many great yogis. There's many stories. Lama Yeshe meditated for a while in his at the time of his when he looked like he was dead. You know, one of his own friends, Geshe, some can't think of his name, in Dharamsala, he meditated for 10 days. I remember seeing photos of him through the process of meditating once he had died, once he stopped breathing. This is very common. So the body shrinks radically, but it doesn't stink, you know. But he was sitting up meditating for these 10 days and they had photos of him. And so then eventually the mind leaves, you know. This is very common. Ling Rinpoche, His Holiness Dalai Lama's root guru, meditated for 13 days. This is very common. They stay at the clear light level and they're totally conscious at that level and they can do all their meditations and get realized and get become a Buddha and blah, blah, blah. But for ordinary beings, we go through this process and we go through this process every time we sleep but we're not conscious of it. It's like you're going, it's like you're driving past the same thing every day but your eyes are closed. You just don't notice it. So we go through this but it's so subtle we're not conscious, you know. We're not practiced and we're not conscious. So we can stay at this point for 3 days before the mind finally leaves, you know, and then there are various indicators of if the mind having left the body. The simplest one is once the person's, you know, stopped breathing, if you put your hand over, because everything in this model, everything is dissolved to the heart chakra, everything, there's this subtle physical energies, and there's this very, you know, intricate process it all goes through, getting ever more subtle, everything comes to the heart chakra. And there's this very subtle, indestructible drop there, they call it, which began at the time of conception and from which all our channels and business grew, which is in this model. And then at the time of death, everything comes back to this. And this is where the very subtle consciousness is residing. And then, so if you put your hand over here, don't touch the body, you put your hand over here, you feel warmth. Cold feet, cold head. But if you feel warmth here, that's a sign the mind is still there. And when it feels cold there, you know the mind has left. So traditionally in the Tibetan Buddhist, they would say you don't touch the body for 3 days, which obviously for most people is quite hard. You know, if you die in a hospital, forget it. They're not going to give you the bed for 3 days. And so in this book, there are, you know, clear instructions traditionally of what to do during those 3 days. But for people who've only got a half an hour, you know, there's certain things you can do to protect the person, to make sure the mind leaves and so on and so forth, you know. So then what happens when the mind leaves the body? Remember, the karma is determined already before you stop breathing, pretty much, the next life. Already programmed. Then when you leave the body, and it could be immediate, if you're going to have a lower realm rebirth, you don't hang around too long because there's plenty of opportunities for them, you know. But when the mind does leave the body, it then wakes up, if you like, in this sort of, in a type of rebirth called the, in a type of experience called the intermediate state or the bardo. And this is very, this is exactly the same as a dream. You go through this process when you get to the clear light mind, deep unconscious and clear light, then you wake up in a dream, don't you? And that's your subtle consciousness in dreams. So here, you wake up in this intermediate state, and they talk about how it can last up to 49 human days, but, you know, after 7 days, you kind of have a mini death in the intermediate state and take another little rebirth in the intermediate state until your new mummy and daddy are sorted, organized. So in our case, we can deduce, let's say, we'll use my example. I must have been conceived in about May 1944 because I got born December 20, 1944, and I came out 7 months early. 2 months early, sorry, not 7 months. Well, so then that means about May. So around about May, I must have died. And my mummy and daddy are there doing their trip in Melbourne, okay? But before that, I must have died, then I'm hanging out in the intermediate state. And what you're doing, you're driven by this frantic grasping, desperately looking for another basis of another rebirth. You know, you might even see your own body, but you have no memory of who you are. You don't know anything. It's all gone, you know? But you're in this intermediate state, which is pretty intense. Even if you're going to get a human birth, it's like a dream, you know? You push from pillar to post. And you're desperately, instinctively craving for another basis of another I, unless you're a high being. And then eventually what will happen, in my case, I will suddenly see my new mummy and daddy in Melbourne, you know, and you run like a magnet. And this sounds hilarious. Freud would really have liked this. Okay? What's going to happen is you'll have this powerful attachment to have sexual union with your father if you're going to get born a girl, so in my case. And this attachment pushes your mind, drives your mind to that, to have that union with your father. Honest, it's so this attachment we talk about, whether you see, in Buddha's view, attachment, whether it's for a cake, whether it's to kill somebody, or whether it's for sex, it's the same attachment. But we talk about the sexual one as some special deal, and even the Christians say it's a gift from God and all that business. That's why it's called a sacrament, you know? But Buddha just says it's delusion. And it's what drives us every microsecond. And depending on your habit, whether you're attached to having sex with a body or killing a fish or whatever it might be. But we're driven by attachment. This is, we're in a desire realm. Attachment is the motor that drives us every millisecond, every millisecond. Fortunately, we've got a few other virtues in there that can help us make some choices. Aren't we lucky, you know, humans? So this attachment is driving you, frantically wanting another rebirth. Then, because this is a desire realm, you see, this is where it doesn't fit with our Buddhist model, the Western model. It's like a joke. Eons ago, before this human planet, okay? Before this human planet. Human is a word for a type of mind. That's all. But eons ago, a human mind was much more advanced. Before this planet, we had a human, if it was we say we because we own it, but we might not have been a human eons. We have been it before. So when we were human eons ago, our mind was very subtle. Our gross energies were not like this bag of bones here, you know, this walking sewer, which is what we have now. Was the wind energies were very subtle, light energy. There were no gross delusions, therefore no gross senses, which have created these. Our delusions have created these senses, created this gross body. Over eons of time, then we gradually got more polluted. It's like evolution of the human realm became more polluted. The delusions came more strong. This gradually polluted the winds, which gradually began to grow holes, which is called the senses. And eventually we land on this planet, I don't know how many thousands of millions of years ago. Don't use the model that the Westerners use necessarily. At what point it became human, I don't know. But then suddenly we started getting born on this planet looking like a bunch of apes. Bit depressing. Okay, so this is a desire realm. This world, this universe, this is the all-pervasive suffering and the third kind of suffering and the first noble truth, okay? We are in the nature of suffering. This universe, this world we know, is the product of attachment. It's the product of attachment. No choice. It's a product of attachment. So it's attachment that drives us to the next rebirth. It's not God. It's not a blessing. It's not a gift. Your mummy and daddy don't do it. They're just my mummy and daddy, believe me, were not thinking about me. They were doing their trip and my history with them ripened. My karma, my history with those two people ripened. It already began before I stopped breathing. Already that life was determined. And I'm in the bardo freaking out, wonder where they are. I don't know who they are yet. And then mummy and daddy doing their trip, Teddy and Billy. My mummy was called Agnes Bliss. I'm called after my auntie Rabina Bliss. So mummy, Agnes, and my daddy, Teddy, were in doing their thing in Melbourne, May 44, somewhere around there. And then I see them, and I run like a magnet, just driven by my attachment. And believe me, if I died in, say, Africa, you don't have to climb on a plane and get to Melbourne. You just go there. That millisecond later, I'm rushing to my daddy. And then there's this anger arises at the thwarted attachment, because I'm just this mind, you know. What can I do? All I see is the two sex organs, very depressing, very distressing. So that causes me to die in the intermediate state, and then that causes me to go rushing into that egg and sperm. That's conception. So what a way to start life, you know? God, no wonder there's pedophilia. There's no wonder there's suffering of attachment on this earth. I'm not kidding here. This is a desire, on Buddha says. It's created by attachment. Created by attachment, you know? Okay, let me just finish. Nearly finished. Just me. Hang on, Holly. So, for a holy being, like Lama Yeshe, let's say, who passed away in meditation, he lives with his body when he feels like it, he's in complete control, he can choose. He can be in a pure land, in a subtle state of bliss, taking teachings from the Buddhas if he likes, and then at some point he went into the womb of his student called Maria in Spain, and then he got born as a little Spanish boy, he's now 30 or something, you know. But they can choose their rebirth. We're just driven by karma, you know. So that's roughly how it happens. So, question, Holly. Microphone, please, darlings. Yeah.
Can you kindly once again explain the relationship between the elements and the physical body?
The elements?
And my second question.
What do you mean by the elements and the physical body?
Water, earth,
yeah.
Fire, and air.
Yeah.
And the relation between the body and the physical process when you're leaving.
When what? Say it again.
The relationship between the earth elements into the physical body elements.
Yeah.
And the subtle energies. So you said fire, which related to a particular consciousness, I believe. And air and water, which is the liquids.
Oh, you mean the inner sign that arises?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, when the earth element ceases, the inner sign is the mirage. Is that what you mean?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, the mirage. You think about it, what is a mirage? Interplay of earth and water, isn't it? It's the vision of looking like water shining on earth, isn't it? Wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
So then this is my way of saying it. The earth element ceases, it gives immediately giving rise now to the prevalence of the water element. Then when the water element ceases, the inner sign is like smoky, which sort of seems to me like steamy. The interplay of water and the next one, which is fire. You understand what I'm saying? It's just my way of saying it. It makes sense. Then when that gives rise to the next one is the fire element. That's prevalent. And when that ceases, the inner sign is like sparks. And what is sparks but the air and air? And the next one, fire and air, isn't it? Fire and air, sparks, isn't it?
Right.
You understand?
But these are just simply terms. I mean, there are no actual sort of physical elements of these things. They're just terms that describe the process.
Which terms?
The terms of water, air, earth,
they're actual elements. It is the Buddhist, just like in the Christian times of Galileo, the Western theories, everything was based on the same model, the four elements. It was how we were constructed. No, this is the Buddhist explanation of physical energy. It is literally made up of the four elements. That is what they're saying, that they are real. It's just their model. We don't use this in the materialist view anymore. We use all the millions of other elements. They talk about when you study medicine. But in the Christian teaching, in the Middle Ages, this is exactly how they talk. Even the medical system was based on this. It was the same thing. The airs, the ethers, you know, they'd have, you know, they're just the same as the Chinese one. This is what we're made of. We are made of the four elements. This is exactly Buddha's model. And the universe is made of the same four elements. And this is natural. They're beginningless. No one made them. Okay. This is exactly what, and each being has their own, each mind, this is the point in Tantra, each mind has its own set of four elements, and we're inextricably linked to those four elements. So when you get down to the very subtle level, there is very subtle consciousness inextricably linked to a very subtle wind energy, which is the subsumed four elements of Holly when she dies, or the lion when it dies. It comes down to the very subtle consciousness linked with, they're like one entity, very subtle wind.
Clear.
This is actually how they're saying, literally.
And my second question.
Yeah.
What happens to the consciousness of somebody who commits suicide?
Well, let's analyze it. Let's analyze karma, okay? So, no, keep the mic. Keep the mic. So first, any action we do, in order for the action we do to become a complete action, which is to say it puts a karmic seed in the bank vault of complete karmas. All these bank vaults of seeds, okay? In our bank, there's a vault called for complete karmas. Every time there's an action that's got four things in place, and I'll describe them, that's a complete karma, and that's the one in number two of the 12 links, which is activated at the time of death, and it'll grab one of those seeds depending on the way you die, and that'll become the throwing karma. It throws you into the next life. So there's four conditions in place for any action we do in order for it to qualify as a complete action, which becomes the karma that throws you into a life, that causes a rebirth. You with me? Mm-hmm. Okay, so the first one is intention. And this is the meaning of the word karma, like I said. If intention has to be there. So let's use a simple example of killing a mouse in my kitchen. Okay? First, there has to be the thought, I will kill. Secondly, there's got to be the mouse. It's got to be the object. Holly, you listening? Third is, you've got to do the action or directly ask someone else to do it. And fourth is, the mouse has to die before me. Strictly speaking, intention, I will kill. The mouse is there. I do the action. The mouse is dead and I cheer. Great, dead mouse. Simply speaking, that's called a complete action of killing. Now, Holly could have a mouse in her kitchen and she doesn't even see it. Right? Her mind is full of compassion cooking for her husband. But she kills the mouse. So there was a mouse, she did the action, and the mouse died before her. Do you agree? But look, there's no intention, is there? She didn't even see it. Well, you could say literally, therefore no karma. Karma means intention. Karma means intention. It's much more nuanced than this and more subtle and more sophisticated in the way it all works, but this is giving a really simple example. You could say when there's no intention, there is no karma. Simple. But this is not enough yet. It's not the whole story. Let's look in my situation. So I had the intention to kill the mouse. And you're innocent and you go, why do you want to kill the mouse, Rabina? Why would you want to do that? And I'll say, well, I can't stand mice. What do you think? And let's face it, what's the normal reason you kill on this earth? I either want to eat mouse feet for dinner, which means I'll kill it very gently so I can have nice mouse flesh. You with me? It's attachment, isn't it? Which is why we kill fish and the things like that. Or it's aversion, isn't it? Or maybe you think you get enlightened if you kill a mouse. That's ignorance. There's only either of these three. You see, attachment, because you want to eat the mouse flesh. Anger, which is the usual reason most people harm each other. Look at the world. Look at the world, please. Look at the world. What do you think the motivation is? Anger. Guess what? Anger, isn't it? And that is underneath the intention. So you have intention, which is bare bones, the thought, I will kill. Thinking of it this way is very simple. There's no good nor bad in this. You know, when let's say I'm doing kung fu. I used to do kung fu. And I'm sparring with Jeff. My intention is to punch Jeff as strong as possible. But I don't want to harm him. That's not my goal. It's not my goal. We're doing it with game. We're both bought into the agreement. We're going to do kung fu. We're going to do sparring. And the aim is to punch. Of course I have to punch him. The clearer I am, the better I'll punch him. But my wish is not to harm him. I love Jeff. He's my friend. So you can say straight away, the intention is to punch, but you've got to look at the reason behind the punch, isn't it? My intention is to, my intention is to kill, and the normal reason packed into that intention is aversion. And that aversion, this is a Mahayana interpretation, that aversion, not even the intention, that aversion is what causes me to create negative karma when I kill. You can have a mouse in your kitchen. Tekchok has a mouse in his kitchen. He sees the mouse, but he sees it suffering, okay? And he has huge compassion. He wants to help the mouse. All he wants to do is help the mouse. His mind is overwhelmed with compassion. But let's say he's not a Buddhist, he doesn't understand about reincarnation, and he naturally thinks, because the world thinks it, I must kill the mouse. So he has the intention to kill. The mouse is there. He does the action. The mouse is dead, and he's rejoicing the mouse is dead. But look at his reason. Well, they are two completely different actions. Mine, because I wanted to harm the mouse, and I assume that by killing it, I'll harm it, then I created heavy-duty negative karma, and that goes as a throwing karma into my throwing karma bank, which will ripen as countless negative suffering lives in the future, because karmic seeds multiply, like all seeds do. They bring many fruits. You could argue, TikTok's action, he created virtue. He wished to help the mouse. Even if the mouse took a terrible rebirth, he sent the mouse from the frying pan into the fire, which is why his action is not enough. Compassion is not enough, as Lama Zopa says. Meaning well is not enough. He needs to have wisdom. So from his point of view, though, this is the crucial point here, from his point of view, his intention was to kill, but his reason was to help. Even though he was deluded, it actually made the poor mouse get a worse rebirth. But that's the mouse. He even, because his motivation was pure, you could argue he created good karma, because it's the motivation that determines the imprint that's left in your mind. It's obviously more subtle. There's many more things to consider here, but this is an example. And then Holly didn't create any karma at all, period. There was no intention. So it's a simple example. Okay, getting to Holly's point now. So let's analyze what's in the mind of a person who decides to kill themselves. So the intention is, I will kill myself, isn't it? Would you agree that's the intention? It's not, I'll go and take a tap, I'll go and have a steak. I will kill myself. So I don't think they qualify that as a complete action of killing. I don't quite know why. But never mind, let's look at the motivation. So what would be a reason a person would kill themselves? What would be a reason? Huh? They're suffering. So if you're suffering, and the reason, you don't want suffering, do you? And that's aversion. See, that's called aversion. That's called anger. You're feared, you're freaked out, you can't stand the pain anymore. You'd say your mind is not happy, isn't it? Wouldn't you agree with that? And it's deluded, isn't it? It's deluded. I mean, anger, not being mean. I mean, pain is terrible. We agree. So it's not a happy mind, is it? Oh, I'm so blissful, I must kill myself. Would you agree? Not like that. Now, even let's say we could argue, I don't know the minds of those Tibetans who all slaughter themselves at the moment, of turning themselves into fire, isn't it? Burning themselves. I don't know what their minds are doing. But even, and this is where it's so sad, because if you see them running down the street screaming, I think you can deduce that they're suffering, wouldn't you agree? So to die with an unhappy mind like that would be really intense, isn't it? But look at their motivation. I bet their motivation maybe was pure, maybe was to try and show something about Tibet, deluded maybe. But then, whereas, you think about the people, I always think about those Vietnamese monks in the Vietnam War. You see the pictures of them sitting in meditation, and they weren't freaking out. Well, we can deduce that they had single-pointed concentration, And they went into a subtle state of mind. And when you go to a subtle state of mind, you don't feel your body at all. You're not there. So they didn't suffer. You could argue this. I don't know their minds, but you could deduce that they did that. So maybe their motivation was pure. That means there was no negativity. And then when they died, their mind didn't freak out. But those poor Tibetans, maybe you could argue they had a good motivation. But look what happened when you're running down the street burning. Your mind is completely panic-stricken. This can would seem it could only ripen a negative state in your bank to ripen for a happy life. I don't know. I'm just trying to analyse. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's what the mind does on that person. You could even think of a person who kills themselves because they know there's no money in the family and the family wants to spend all the money on their medical care and they truly have compassion for their children and they truly have compassion and they do it with a happy mind. It's a possibility, I think. But let's face it, I mentioned, you know, in 2010 they did the numbers of all the suicides in 2010. Remember I said yesterday? And it's even more than I thought. It was 680,000 other deaths in the whole world, unnatural deaths, and there was 880,000 suicides. So I don't think most people kill themselves with a blissful mind, quite frankly. So I think we can deduce negativity is in their mind at the time, which causes can only cause suffering and rebirth, can't it?
And would then they still go through the same process of death as a person that was dying naturally?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. The process of death, these eight stages, you always go through them, but it's like sort of falling down a building or climbing down a ladder. The normal process, which takes time, is climbing down slowly. But if you fall, you go quicker, don't you? But you still go through the same stages. So the eight stages naturally happen. But a sudden death, like a violent death, they tend to say that you go through so quickly and you can even leave your body immediately and go to the lower realms, you know, go to the intermediate state. But you still go through them, but there's no awareness, God. Or a person who's sitting there eating their breakfast and they fall drop dead right there. Obviously, they go through the stages extremely quickly, but they still go through them. But there's no ability to be aware of it, is there? Same with the person who kills himself, or who dies suddenly, violent death, isn't it? Mm. So you could say a person who kills themselves but doesn't die yet, but dies slowly, and if they change their mind and have bliss and regret, and then that's possible, that can change, you know. The bottom line is it's not punishment, it's not reward, it's a question of knowing what arises in the mind, and that's what determines the karma we create. It's not set in stone. So that means we have to know a person's mind. It's very hard to do that, you know. Do you see? Okay. So does that answer your question, sweetheart? Does that answer your question?
Yes.
What's your... Please, microphone there. Coming in a second. Microphone, please. Go, darling.
Yeah, I was just going to ask... It seems to be a phenomenon, and I witnessed it with my own mother, who died quite recently, that a lot of people who are dying don't want to die with the people who love them around them. They kind of need, they somehow need to be alone in that moment.
Tell us about your mummy. What happened? You said your mother,
she was
like that.
I mean, she was in hospital, you know, for several weeks. And then, you know, my sister and I were with her.
Mm-hmm.
But we just decided to go off and have a coffee, have something to eat. And we kind of knew that she was close to the end.
Okay, I hear you.
And that's, I just, you know, I suppose it's haunted me a bit that she was on her own.
No, okay. What that's about is this, I would suggest. This is very common. Because if a person had, okay, if a person's practicing their life and they accept impermanence and they're ready and they want and they know, let's say they're even Christian. Was your mummy Christian or something? No.
No, she didn't have any beliefs.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah.
So the normal one is when you're dying, this craving arises, fearful of death, don't want to die. And so then as long as you've got stuff or things or people around you that you're attached to, you'll keep clinging to them and they can keep you alive for days and weeks. The minute that goes, there's nothing to hold on to. So then you die. Even I remember a woman I was with who was frantic with fear about dying. And she wanted the television on the whole time. Anything to hold on to. The attachment needs something to grasp at. And then we tried to put a video of Lama Yeshe on and the video broke. So the whole thing didn't work. Well, she died almost immediately. There was no longer anything to cling to because attachment needs an object. So I think for your mummy, if she's an ordinary person, she didn't want to be on her own to die. She just, you weren't there and she was able to sink into, you know, the attachment. As long as you're there in front of her, she's clinging to you. This attachment at the time of death is really quite subtle, quite primordial, which is why they say it is unbelievably important at the time of death to enable a person to be peaceful, to help them, you know, by peacefully, to have peaceful things around them. Maybe, you know, even if they're not Buddhist, to have peaceful mantras or something that allow them to be peaceful, not to grasp, to be very quiet, not to rabbit on, not to show all this neurotic emotion. And even, it sounds awful, but people they've got very strong attachment to, they shouldn't be in the room. or indeed very strong aversion for. So it's really got to be a very special setting to help the person to have a peaceful, happy mind.
And I mean, the custom in most countries, you know, certainly in my mum's case, you know, I mean, okay, we were allowed to stay with her for a couple of hours, but right. then she was in a hospital and
that's
you
right.
know, she's taken away. And when
that's
you're
right.
talking about, you know, 3 days,
that's right.
it just feels like a really cold, you know, ideally, if you're
of
able
course.
To,
that's
as
right.
you say, have, mm. you know, have time.
That's right. That's
you
right.
can, but I mean,
I
the way our world works,
I
it just, it's like,
that's right.
it's just like a machine.
It is exactly. And that's why it's really, ideal scenario for a person who's got a Buddhist lifestyle to try and die at home, you know, because then you have control over it. And it used to be that you'd bring your old grandma home, but you're not allowed to. You know, they won't let, certainly in the States, I remember we tried to do it with a friend who died. They wouldn't let us take the body. So then we had to negotiate with the memorial home, or the, what do they call the morgue, where we could have the body there. We did prayers all day. And then they don't allow you. So after 4 p.m., they wouldn't let us stay. So they promised us that we gave them a tape of the Gyuto monks. And they promised us they'd put it on in the fridge overnight so they could hear. So then when we came back the next day and we stayed with them another day, you can negotiate in this way. But the aim is to not, you don't have to, you know, it's up to each person in their own country. This is in this book, I'm going to try and explain this in this, the way it is. You've got to know you've got some rights, you know. And you don't have to bear, you don't have, and this is a law that says you must cremate them immediately. You don't, you know, find a way where you can have them. Be there and be them with them as long as possible. I mean, when Lama Yeshe passed away in a hospital in Los Angeles, they were very kind. They let him, they took him, they allowed them to take him very quietly and carefully to another room where Lama Zopa and the other students sat all day with him and meditated, you know. That's unusual in hospitals where they're so busy. But there are instructions also anyway in those situations, or when they take the organs, there are things you still can do to help the mind and even to ensure the mind leaves the body. There are things to do.
And if you haven't been able to do any of that, I mean...
Then what can you do? You haven't been able to, that's it. What can you do? People who die in accidents, you know, what can you do? The ideal is to, as much as you can, have some control over it. And we've got, that's where you've got to know your rights in your own country. We all seem to give all the power to the doctors and the funeral homes, and we ring the police and just this, instead of thinking what, you know, even if you die at home, many friends of mine now in different countries just don't call the doctor for 2 days. And I don't know if there's a law about that, but they just don't. Well, they have a sympathetic doctor. So you let the person stay there, you do all the practices, you do the stuff, and then you call the doctor, they announce it, and then when you know the mind's gone, you know, it's dog food now. Give it to the dogs, who cares? I mean, excuse me. So as much as possible to have control over it, if you can. And then still there are things to do if you can't. Even if you have a half an hour, still to do something. 2 hours is pretty good as well. And this is why, okay, they talk about... Here, in the understanding of the subtle physiology, there's all these channels, okay, in the subtle nervous system, and there's one that's called the central channel, which actually goes all the way up in front of the spine towards the back of the body and ends at the crown here. You can sort of feel a point there, you know, you've got a sense of about there, and this chakra, where there's a coming together of several channels, and it's all blocked energy, okay, blocked. And here, there's this crown chakra. At the time of death, the mind, the very subtle consciousness, will leave at different points in the body, which often can be an indicator also of where, of the type of rebirth the person will have, which is one of the reasons why it's really important when the person stops breathing not to touch them. And if you're going to touch them here. And that, by pulling there, it gets you to, you know, if you've got to have half an hour, you tap here very strongly, or you pull their hair if they've got any, and this can encourage the consciousness to leave through the top of the central channel, which is absolutely certain that they'll get a Pure Land rebirth, a rebirth among the Buddhas. This is how they talk, okay? And then if it can leave here, through the eyes, through the sex, through the feet even, and this, the lower down, the more they say that's an indicator it could be a suffering rebirth, you know. So it's important not to touch the body, not to agitate the body. It's really important. This is what they say.
And if you haven't known any of that, I mean, we sat there holding my mum's hands.
There you
know,
go, very so, sweet, but... very kind, darling. So whatever, it's fine. Whatever, we do what we do, you know. If you have the view, which is the Buddhist one, that everything you're doing at the time of death is to help them get the next rebirth. The only reason, it's sort of like if you're going on a plane at 6 o'clock, you are preparing... You're preparing to leave the house, aren't you? But you just don't prepare to leave the house. If you walk out the door and say, oh, I've left the house now, then what? Well, you haven't finished your job. You've got to have an air ticket and be prepared to get to the airport. So the death is a bit like that, and really it's something that's very important for the Buddhist. Like a Christian, the same. You are preparing for death, but death is just the stepping stone to the next life, so you're really preparing for the next life. So be ready, packed, ready to go, you know, with morality and all the rest, blah, blah, blah. Any questions more about the death process? Yes, you had a question, sweetheart. There you go, I'm sorry. Okay, talk to me.
Something has happened sort of recently that's really shaken up my thoughts around suicide and dying. Somebody I know went to Switzerland yesterday. Tomorrow she will be having an assisted suicide.
Right, exactly.
She's been very, very ill, and it's really made me think that tomorrow, because she will be having this planned
yes.
death,
yes.
she will be more conscious, more uh-huh. able okay. to sure. die than sure. she might have done
right.
if she'd been progressively more and more sick.
That's right.
She's planning the music, she's setting up the things right. that we've been talking about.
Yes.
And it's really shaken my thing about, well, what is that wrong?
I understand. So let's look at it. Okay. What's her view for a start about what happens after she dies?
I don't know.
She's not your friend?
She's not close to me. She's okay. my friend's
so,
sister.
Okay. So wrong, what would you say wrong means? What's the meaning of wrong? What's the meaning of wrong?
Because I have this thing, well, suicide, you know, you don't right. do.
Right, so good. Let's analyse. It's an important point. Mm. We've said it, we've talked about it, but let's see if we can unpack it. What, when you say wrong, what do you mean by wrong?
Because I guess I have been told that it's wrong.
Okay, wrong
this
meaning,
is now challenging.
What's your analysis of wrong? I don't care what you've been told.
Because it's wrong to kill.
Okay, good. Why is it wrong? Why is
because
it wrong?
That is then bad karma.
And what does bad karma mean?
That then bad karma means that you will be reborn in a lower rebirth.
Okay, and what causes that to happen?
I'm struggling here.
Okay, we're discussing here. It's good. This is a great conversation. Mm. This is a really important point. Okay. Exactly as you're saying is exactly how we think. Something's wrong, something's right, someone said so, I've heard this, God said that, mummy says that, and then we live in all this, oh, it's wrong, it's right. But this is why I said, why is it wrong? So listen, look at this. It's a very interesting point. Mm.
I used to think that suicide was fine, tried it a couple of times, you know, thought it was my exit.
That's right.
I believe, yes. I came to the conclusion yes. that actually it's wrong.
Okay, good. So let's analyse what's your name?
Sheila,
darling. Let's analyse what we mean by wrong. It's an incredibly important point. Shall we do that?
Yeah.
Okay, Sheila. So, if you're a Christian, and I keep saying that because that's or Muslim, it's a prevalent philosophy on this earth. Wouldn't you agree?
Mm.
Then God is the creator. Were you a Christian? Were you a Christian? You are a Christian.
I guess I was brought up Christian.
Okay, fine, good,
but
darling.
At that
okay,
point,
that's fine.
I've
okay,
left
so
it.
If you're, I was a Christian, I was a Catholic, and I was taught that God was the boss. God created the universe, God created me, and God therefore created the laws of morality. That's reasonable view, and if that is my view, then obviously if God's the boss, and I asked the Catholic priest this, I said, what is a sin by definition? What is wrong by definition? He said, it's when you go against the will of God. So we analyze that's perfect. So that's why then when you do something wrong, it's wrong, listen, because God said so.
Mm-hmm.
Are you hearing me? Now look at, if you're my mummy, and your mummy says, don't do that, then as soon as I do it, I'll go, oh, mummy said, don't do it, I'm naughty. That's our usual dualistic view of morality, isn't it? That's, it's something that someone said from on high that you shouldn't do. You with me?
Yeah.
That's what we think of as wrong and right, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, the Buddha would say that's not enough. Sorry.
Mm.
He says what is wrong or right, what is wrong or negative is really simple. It's an action that causes harm to a sentient being.
Mm.
So you're doing your market research in this room and we will have a survey that has 100% answers. I don't like getting killed. I don't like getting stolen from. I don't like suffering. I don't like my girlfriend cheated on. You get my point here? So it's pretty easy to deduce what a negative action is. Mm. It's one that harms another. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Buddha says it's a natural law.
Yeah.
So but the difference is here, the Buddha's also saying, why he asks us not to do it isn't because he said so, which is what Jesus would say, or mummy. It's because he's found that if I kill, because my intent, my motivation is to harm, that's what harms me. That's what harms me. But the bottom line here is what's called wrong is a natural law, that it's something that causes harm to somebody. So the Buddha would say killing a sentient being is wrong, because for me it's wrong, because when I do it, I want to harm them, don't I? And I have anger in my mind, or fear, don't I? Yeah. And that is what causes me to have suffering, the future negative karma. You with me?
Yeah.
You with me? But here we have Tekchok, who killed a mouse. Killing is wrong. Mice don't want to die, do they? Mm. Whether it's my mouse or his mouse or her mouse, they all three dead mice, okay? Yeah. They don't care whether we have good motivation or bad motivation. Are you with me, Tina?
Yeah.
So in my case, I created negative karma. In each of our cases, the mice didn't want to die. They all got suffering. Mm. In my case, though, I created negative karma when I did it because I wanted to harm them. He created good karma because he wanted to help them. She didn't create either because she didn't even have an intention. So there's two things. One is, what is a negative action? It's one that harms another. But two, when you do it, what makes you create negative karma?
Right.
Are you with me, Sheena?
Yeah.
So suicide, if we look at the motivation, normally it's fear, it's delusion, it's anger, it's panic, and all these dramas. And the mind can't be peaceful when it's fearful. That's a very simple point. And if we have the view that this friend of yours, the Buddha's view is that her mind will continue, okay? Mm. So the only way we can say whether she will get a really good rebirth, which is what the Buddhists would want for her, the only way to know that is that when she goes through this process of death, she's got a big bucket load of virtuous karmic seeds, which will ripen, which will throw her into another rebirth, and that has to come from strong virtue in her mind.
Right.
Now, you can't guarantee there's going to be virtue there as she's going through the process.
No.
You can't guarantee unless she's done the work in her mind during her life.
Mm.
So I would maybe suggest, I'm not trying to judge anybody, that if you've thought about dying, you're obsessed with the thought, I'm going to die, I'm going to kill myself, I'm going to die, it's my right, I'm allowed to. It's hardly a virtuous state of mind. It's a very self-centered view. Because I'm allowed to, it's my right, it's my life. It's very self-centered, it's not thinking of others. If she is thinking of others, if she does have compassion in her mind, then it's virtuous. But if it's just self-centered, don't be surprised she dies with fear and panic and that it chucks her mind into a lower realm rebirth. But you can't say, but you've got to do this type of analysis.
Right.
Because it's a logical thing, not a moralistic thing. Mm. Are you with me?
Yeah. Right. I mean,
so darling, if you want to help your friend, what I would do if I were a Buddhist, I'd be on the email my friends in the monastery in Koh Phan and know exactly the time she's going to die and get the monks there to do really strong prayers to help her mind go through this process.
Right.
This is what you do as a Buddhist to help her, because you can even guarantee she might even die before. You never know.
Mm.
But given that she will die at the time she organizes it, it's a great way to help her. But that's assuming you're a Buddhist and you like these ideas. You know, this is certainly one way you'd help her. At least help her, you know.
Yeah.
If she has the karma to ripen that's called virtuous, then great, she'll get another decent rebirth.
Mm.
Obviously, she thinks she'll just disappear, doesn't she? She's probably a materialist.
So, yeah.
That's right, yeah.
Mm. Thank you very much.
So what's her name?
Her name?
Yes.
Maggie.
Maggie what? I'll go in personal, like I don't care. But
Maggie,
what time
McGuire.
She going to die? I'll do a prayer for her. What time she going to die?
I don't know.
Well,
but I will certainly try and find out. Yes.
If you can, we can do a prayer for Maggie at the time at 3 o'clock when she pulls the plug.
Yes.
Thank you
very much indeed.
Bye, darling. Thank you. Yes, sweetheart. Yes, Valerie. I'm going to hear another Valerieist idea here. What's your Valerie's philosophy here? Come on, Valerie. Keep it simple.
Yes.
Straight to the point. Come out with it.
I have a very difficult question to ask.
Is it?
I'm scared of the answer. But
you're scared of me or scared of the answer?
I'm scared of you.
People tell me that all the time. It's a nice girl, honestly. As I told one of my friends in prison that I swear, he said, Rabina, you don't. You're a nice old lady. You're just a little old lady, he said. That's right.
I'm scared of you, Buddha.
All right, darling, go on. Go on, what's your question?
Okay, if a child dies in the womb...
Yes.
Before it's due to
die. That's right, yes.
Die.
Yes.
Is it suicide?
No, not suicide, darling.
Or is it killing?
It's just calm. Okay, I'll tell you. I'll tell you the answer. The length of life of any sentient being, the main cause of it is the amount of morality in their petrol tank. So this little, you know, sentient being, let's say the little girl in the womb there, she won the lottery by getting a human rebirth. She died, a virtuous karma ripened, it threw her into a human mummy's womb, but it she didn't have enough in her petrol tank. It ran out after 3 months, so she just miscarried, or she was aborted, one or the other. So if she was aborted, that's the fruit of her having killed before. And if she just ran out of life, that's the fruit, also the fruit of killing. One of the consequences of killing is that you will get killed, in which case an abortion. The other one is you die young. So she would have had either one of those. So it's just the result of negative karma, yeah. Yeah. That all?
Yes.
Wasn't so hard, was it? Hmm? Wasn't so difficult?
No.
Was the answer difficult?
No.
Okay, good, darling. Any more questions?
It wasn't the responsibility of the mother.
If she'd killed her, cruel it is.
No,
if she didn't, then it's not.
If the child died before the birth, you know.
You mean if she was miscarried?
No, it wasn't a miscarriage, it was stillbirth.
Well, that's called miscarriage, isn't it? No. Yeah, miscarriage is a term for when the baby dies young, isn't it, in the womb?
No,
What? The baby was born dead. Well, that's called whatever. I see, check medical terms. Their life ran out, didn't it?
Yeah.
That means that she didn't have enough petrol in her morality tank. It lasted only a few months. That's all. Okay. Whether she miscarried or had an abortion or stillborn. For the baby, the karma was... all of those were due to past killing karma. Okay, all the four ways that karma ripens. Remember we talked about the four ways your karma ripens. One is your type of rebirth. Two is your tendencies. Three is your experiences. And four is the environment. So let's use any example of any action, virtuous or non-virtuous, can have any of these four. So if killing ripens at the time of death, lower realm rebirth. But in our case... virtue ripened, morality, non-killing karma, and as Lama Zopa puts it, nourished in the context of a spiritual practice, and not only that, but nourished in the context of keeping vows of morality. This is the cause of how come we got this human birth. He says just being good is not enough. We must have created so much virtue. So we got a human life, but look at all the humans on this earth. The vast majority, I would suggest, have a tendency to kill, don't they? The ants, the cockroaches, the fish, each other. Most humans, it's rare, even most religions would say killing's okay, certain people. So you could say that the second way killing ripens is as the tendency, which is the worst one. The third way killing ripens is as an experience, which is the case of the stillborn and the miscarriage. They died young. Or either one of those, or you get killed. You get killed or you die young. That's the third, that's called experience, similar to the cause, in this case, of killing. The action similar to the cause, which is the tendency to kill, is obviously from the habit of killing. The experience similar to the cause is you get killed or you die young. And then the fourth one is environmental karma. You know, she gets born, this little baby, and she's allergic to peanuts and allergic to milk, and the water's polluted, and the filth, and the environment will harm you instead of supporting your health. That's the fourth way killing would ripen. So any and all the actions, virtuous or non-virtuous, have any of these four? Can have. Yeah.
Yes, Peter. I have two other questions.
Yes, darling.
If I can.
Keep them simple.
Yes. Is the I don't know, I've written it down, I'm trying to. Is the emptiness of the I,
yes,
the universal love and peace that unite us as...
Would you say
energy?
That again, Valerie? I'm beginning to like what you're saying. What did you say? It sounded tasty. Say it again.
Is the emptiness of the I, the universal love and peace of the energy that connects us all?
Okay. The Buddhist way of saying that would be, when Valerie has realized the emptiness of her I, she will have universal love. Because what's preventing her from having universal love is the clinging to her own separate I. They actually say the final delusion to go before you become an enlightened mind is the sense of subject-object, the sense of separateness. I mean, this sounds so weird to us because we know we're all separate eyes, but this is a result of the delusion. So once you've finally uprooted all the misconceptions, all the nonsense in the mind, there's no longer a sense of separate, you and me. It's like your eye is as big as the universe now, you could argue that, and you have infinite love and compassion for every single sentient being as if they were you. No sense of separateness at all. So it's the grasping at the separate eye, the neurotic eye, which is the cause of feeling separate and only having love for a few people and not having, you know, do you understand, all the delusions and the suffering. So when you've seen the emptiness of the fantasy eye, then you're going to have this love for all beings, definitely. Okay, someone over here. Yes? What, sweetheart?
So then, for example, lamas or high realized people are leaving us, like, for example, Lama Yeshe.
I can't hear your words, darling.
Cannot, all right. Karma. So when high realized people, like for example Lama Yeshe, he was very young, and in this case, the same question would be that we don't have that positive karma to
don't have what?
We don't have the karma to listen, and you know that people who are here that we cannot listen anymore, Lama Yeshe, or you know what I mean? That why the masters die so, for example, in early age then.
Well, first of all, let's assume there's a person who has high realizations, okay? Meaning, or depending on how high, but let's just say they're a highly evolved bodhisattva or a Buddha, either way, let's say even, then they're well and truly past, at a certain stage of development, you're well and truly past having any karma to suffer. You finish that. If you're a Buddha, you finish that. So the only reason you would take a body, because you've well and truly gone past the need to have a body. So the only reason you take a body is because of compassion for sentient beings. So first of all, for the person. So the Dalai Lama is said to be a Buddha. Okay, I don't know, but they say he is. Which means he doesn't need a body. He has no delusions. He has no negative karma left. He couldn't possibly have suffering. No possibility. But out of his compassion, he manifests as this Tibetan person to help sentient beings. Do you understand? So let's say, you know, let's say he's around at a certain time and he dies young. Well, the only way to interpret that, if he is a holy being, if he is a Buddha, the only way to interpret that is that the karma of all the sentient beings, they're not practicing, or they have some karma to not have him, like you just said before. And it would be seen as the karma, the result of the karma of the sentient beings. Because if he has no karma himself, it can't be from his side. That would be the way to say it. Do you understand? Pardon? I can't hear you. Who has to practice?
It means that that this is the way that if you are watching our mind and if we are really practicing, then these beings can teach us more or longer.
Well, the thing is, if you understand that a Buddha, let's say a Buddha, well and truly, like I said, has gone past the need to have a body. From their own side, they're finished. They don't need. The only reason they manifest is to benefit sentient beings. So obviously they're only going to manifest where they're needed. They're not going to sort of bash their heads against brick walls. If they're not needed, they won't be there. It's very obvious. So we have to create the cause to hear their teachings. Of course. That's right. Exactly. That's right. Yes, Holly.
With Lama Yeshe passing so young, that was a result of students not having the karma.
You could argue, you know, you could say, teachings. Well, no, put it this way. Who knows what the causes were, but as a student of Lama Yeshe, no, keep it. As a student of Lama Yeshe, my job, by understanding my relationship with that Lama, my seeing that Lama as a Buddha, that's my responsibility, right? To see him as a Buddha. So therefore these teachings for me would apply, and I'd have to get a learning from that to realize that my karma to hear my Lama's teachings ran out. So not to feel guilty and want to kill myself from that, but to learn from it and then to want to continue to practice and not waste time. That would be the learning for me. But if, say, Lama Yeshe was my brother and he was just my mate, I would just think of Lama having a heart attack and he died, you know? So it depends on your view and the person, your relationship with that person, how you see it. And then anyway, as far as the person's concerned, it's up to the karma, that person, whether they are a Buddha or not. So it's up to, there's two different things there. From their side, what they really are, and from our side, how we would see them, and the way we interpret that experience, interpret that event. Do you see? I mean, the way Lama Zopa says it, that everything, you know, this is emptiness. Everything we experience is our own karmic appearance. So one of the ways, for example, your own habit from killing in the past would ripen, say, environmentally, would be you live in a war zone where people are killing each other all the time, people are dying young all the time, people are getting sick. That's an environmental karmic result for you. For them, it's the result of their karma, but you are around that, surrounded by that, because that's your karmic appearance, you have dying, people dropping off like flies everywhere, you know? Are you with me, people? Okay. Yes? Yes, darling.
So what does it say about the karma of the person who's the baby dies or has a stillbirth?
Yes.
I take what you're saying, that the baby has used up its, it has no, can't live any longer. But it must say something, it must be to do with the karma of the person who loses the baby too.
Of course, there's a strong history there. Yeah, if you go, if you're my beloved and we're married, pretend, you know, I like boys anyway, but let's say you're a boy and we're married, and then you go and leave me for a younger version. It says something about you, your attachment, but it says something about me that I must have created the cause to have my relationship cut off. So that's from sexual misconduct in the past. One of the consequences of sexual misconduct is that your relationships never last. People cheat on you. They lie to you. You're always surrounded by deceptive other people. People die on you. That's my particular karma. Of course it is. So the karma of the mother who loses the baby is the karmic result of one karma she did in the past, action of relationships finishing. Yes, absolutely. Okay. Each person's got their own experience of that thing, and each person's experiencing that from their past actions. Absolutely.
And the other thing was, when you speak about the death process, so it's a dissolution of all the aggregates except for the karmic formations.
Karmic formation ceases. What do you mean? But, well, all the aggregates have to go. They're gone by the time you stop breathing.
Isn't it the karma? Isn't that...
That ripens at the time of death. That ripens. Already it ripens before you stop breathing. Already you're on the next track for the next life. It ripened before you even stopped breathing, karmic formation, the second link, and the aggregate.
But then we call karmic imprints the things that you're born with.
The seeds. We call karmic imprints, it's imprint or seed. So all the actions we did in the past, so a few actions we did in the past, ripened at the time before we stopped breathing. The throwing karma ripens that I would get Rabina's body into, you know, Agnes and Teddy's womb. All the tendencies that are Rabina's personality, all the experiences related to Rabina's life, you know, and the environmental, all of those came together to produce already before I stopped breathing, already there's a manifesting ready, and those karmic seeds then are now will ripen as that new experience. So the karmic formation is the second of the links, isn't it? That ripens already, then it already is programming for the new fruit to come. So the seed's already gone, finished. Now the fruit comes. And then we carry with us in our very subtle consciousness, a way to say it, is all the seeds that haven't yet ripened.
Thank you.
Latent until they meet the conditions. Yeah. What an interesting day. It's like question and answer the whole day, isn't it? Are you okay? People are not unhappy with this? You all right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Go, go, go.
I work with children and young people who are experiencing a mental health crisis.
Yes,
and I work
amazing.
A lot with families.
Wonderful.
So I'm kind of working with a lot of karma.
Yes, absolutely.
And it seems to be my karma to be in that situation.
There you go,
and
to help people. How fantastic.
And I find it hard to kind of accept that this is the child's karma.
Yeah, I understand. So let me ask you, may I ask you a question? Do you know some children who have a beautiful family? Do you know some children who've got a nice family? Some children, somewhere on this earth, who got... Yourself, for example. Did you have a reasonable mummy and daddy?
Yeah, yeah.
A reasonable condition. Reasonable money in the bank. Reasonable kindness, reasonable medical benefits, reasonable food. Yeah, you had a fairly nice life, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I just can't understand why that happens. What did a person do to get a good life? Why do good things happen? We never ask that, do we? We only ever ask why do bad things happen. And that is a really interesting point. So what we're really saying is, I don't like seeing suffering. How dare suffering attack itself upon me? And we're not really saying I don't know why. We're saying I don't like it. That's why we never, ever agonize, why do good things happen to me? Why do good things happen to me? We never, 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 never ask that question. It's only the bad ones. And why, if we look underneath, instinctive ego is desperately believing I deserve good things. Give me more. That's attachment. And how dare bad things happen? I don't deserve it. That's aversion. And that's the instinct of ego. And it's a misconception. I remember a woman in Koppan. We're talking about karma. And she was in a wheelchair. And she was in tears. She said, you mean I'm the blame for this? Right? And I didn't know how to... I thought about how to answer her. And then I said, yes, you are the blame for being beautiful, for having a good mother, for having health, for wanting to practice a spiritual path, for having beloved friends. And then she didn't say anything, she got it. But we never, ever, 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 ever even care why good things happen. because we're junkies for them and we assume we deserve it. And this is what Buddha says is completely irrational. It's like you assume you should have money in the bank without thinking you should work for it. And you're rage and furious because it says minus instead of plus. You have no understanding of where money comes from. You just assume you deserve a big number. It's irrational. If you haven't worked for it, baby, you won't have it. And if you didn't work for it, you'll have a minus. We get that. It's cause and effect, isn't it? But we have no view of cause and effect of me. Just this big fat victim that someone decided to make and plonk on this earth, and you better be a good mother. You're my mother. I mean, it's so arrogant, actually, but this is ego. We're massively arrogant. And it's the junkie expectation. So we dump that on everybody else, and we think it's called compassion. It's not. It's because we don't like seeing bad things. Because, you see, attachment is a junkie that only wants nice things. So you can't stand seeing suffering. The attachment in you... Okay, listen, honey, the compassion in you is why you're doing this job. You want to help people. But the attachment in you can't stand seeing anything ugly. So when you get past that, your compassion will be limitless. Because you'll know that they cause themselves suffering and that breaks your heart for them. Not causes you to think, oh, well, they deserve it.
I think what I'm trying to get clear in my head is it's almost, you know, I feel as though I'm kind of witnessing karma. It's easier for me to witness.
It's ripening. They're negative
and
karma ripening.
Is there any point me actually being there? You know, interfering in someone's karma that's going to ripen anyway. You know,
so what?
Do you know
what I mean?
Of
course it's going to ripen. They created the cause. Meanwhile, while it's ripening, they need people like you.
They
need people like you, dear, to help them. My negative karma is ripening every day when I get sick. What do you think hospitals are for? Because I've also got the karma to be helped. So I need you to be there to help me, please. And if I do have karma to be meeting people like you, aren't I fortunate? But look, lots of people don't have the karma to meet you. So these people, you can rejoice they have the karma also to find people like you who will help them through this suffering. That's what compassion is, baby. Listen, the bodhisattvas, they say they need their enemies. They need suffering sentient beings. What they mean by that is if they didn't have suffering sentient beings, they'd have no basis for compassion. So aren't you fortunate that you're meeting suffering sentient beings? Because you can now, that's the grist for your mill to give you courage and strength to want to be a bodhisattva and never give up wanting to help them. So I'm happy for you. The more suffering, the better.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. It's tea time already, for God's sake. We just had lunch. Go. Where are you? Oh, you missed out on you. Next time. Yes, sweetheart.
For Buddha's sake,
what?
For Buddha's sake.
Who's? What do you want to say for Buddha's sake? What's that mean?
Well, as a Buddhist, do we...
Speak in the mic, sweetie.
Do we have to be prepared to give up our own life in order to save another one, for example?
If you're brave enough, sure, of course. If you got to that level, but don't do it before you're ready, honey. You'll be die of fright. I'll tell you an example, okay? A friend of mine called Harry, I love this story. Harry, everyone says, oh, Harry's a bodhisattva. You know, he's just this nice bloke, as far as I can see. Nice, friendly chap, you know, goes around helping people. But when I heard this story, I figured he must have got to that point of actually giving his life for others. The methods of, this is what I had to talk about, wasn't it? That's right, bodhicitta. Thank you very much. We're going to move into bodhicitta now. So I'll just give you this example, then I'll tell you how we have to get there, okay? So there's Harry. He was at Kopan Monastery one time, Lama Zopa Lama Yeshe's monastery in Kathmandu, and he was getting ready to go up to the mountains where he'd spent many years in retreat. Lama Zopa Rinpoche is a Sherpa from the mountains, you know? And anyway, Lama Zopa, I'll just tell you quickly about Lama Zopa, then I'll tell you about Harry, and then I'll answer your question. So Lama Zopa Rinpoche actually was born up there in about 1945 or 6, and from the time he was born, his mother, every time she turned her back, she'd see little Zopa crawling up the hill, up to where there was a cave of the previous Lama called Kunsang Yeshi, who'd passed away, you know? So every time she turned her back, little Zopa's crawling up the hill, so she drags him home. And then from the time he can talk, he's walking up this hill, you know? Come home! He'd say, no, that is my home. So we can deduce from this is how they talk, that he was the reincarnation of that yogi. So his mother, he kept behaving this way. And when he had games, he acted like a lama. He'd make little torma, mud pie tormas, and he'd say all his benefactors were coming to the puja. And he's announced all the names of his previous life benefactors. So Mummy thought, I better check up. So she checked with a local lama. And it turns out that they say he's the reincarnation of this previous yogi, Khunsang Yeshi. So he got to be known as Rinpoche, precious one, which is the term, you know. So anyway, he got a bit older. Then he went to India when he was 14, when the business happened. And then he met Lama Yeshi. And then in the 60s, they met the students, all the hippies in Kathmandu. And then centres like this developed all over the world. As a result, that's just a rough story there. So Lama Zopa is our boss, okay? He's the one who hired Geshe Tashi to come here. And he's my boss. So anyway, and he's Jeff's, oh no, he's not your boss, is he? Maybe he's your boss. He's Jeff's boss too. And he's a few other people's bosses. Maybe he's Erica's boss. Who knows? Maybe he's TikTok. TikTok works for him in Israel. He's got a little Dharma group in Israel of Lama Zopas. So anyway, there we go. So Lama Zopa, Lama Yeshi. Lama Yeshi passed away when he was 49, as we discussed. And he was reborn as a Spanish boy in Urselling, this place of clear light, it was called by His Holiness in 1982 when he was there, and then in 84 this little boy was born, and he is said to be the reincarnation of Lama Yeshi. So these are the bosses of our organization. So anyway, Lama Zopa, up in the mountains up there, he meditated in the last years of his life in this little kind of cave in the side of the wall, which used to be where they stored the radishes. Or the onions, I don't remember which one, but the term is laudo in their local language. And so he seemed to pull the radishes out and moved in at some point. He spent the last 30 years of his life there. Then he got reborn as little Zopa, okay? So he got to be known as the Laudo Lama, the Radish Lama, okay? So anyway, Harry, like a lot of Westerners, go up to the mountains and little caves and they meditate up there. So Harry has been meditating up there for years. And like I said, people would say, oh yeah, Harry's a bodhisattva. So this story, like I said, seems to indicate that he's somebody. So what happened was he was in Kopan Monastery and he was deciding, packing ready to go up to the mountains to meditate more. And Lama Zopa was there. And Lama Zopa said he had a dream that Harry would die, and he tried to get a message to Harry not to go. So my extra comment here in parentheses is that Lama Zopa doesn't sleep, okay? So he couldn't have had a dream. So obviously he's just being humble, because I would suggest it was his clairvoyance that could see that it was dangerous for Harry. So anyway, they couldn't get a message. So there's another great lama there called Geshe Lama Khonchog, a very dear friend of lamas in Sera Monastery in India, in Tibet. And then when he left Tibet, he went off into caves and meditated for years and years and years, naked, no clothes, no food, highly evolved being. Lama Zopa said he was Vajrayogini. So anyway, he spent his many last years at Kopan Monastery, an old friend of lamas. When Lama passed away at Kopan Monastery, Lama Zopa said all the smiles went away. And then when Geshe Lama Khonchog, this yogi, came, all the smiles came back. So they loved him at Kopan. So he was there too. So Lama Zopa asked him to do some prayers for Harry. So here's the story. And I heard about this story, and I asked Harry to verify it. So from Harry's own mouth, what happened is he was with this other nun, and she was behind, and they're walking up these very treacherous hills. You know, I've never been up there. But people are falling over the, you know, the mountains into their death regularly. It's really intense, including the porters, you know. He's walking up this really treacherous, narrow little pass, and he sees four Sherpas with their big packs coming down the hill. And, you know, a friend of mine used to be a Sherpa, a porter, and he said, Rabina, all I saw was my feet for 10 days, because these big packs, and they're bent over like this, you know. All I saw was my feet for 10 days. So it's kind of intense. Coming down these narrow little passes, it's really dangerous. And so Harry was there, and he saw them coming. He must have been quite close. And he said to himself, he told me, the thought arose in my mind, okay, four of them, one of me, I'll step to the side. So this already has a massive history in this. If we look into all these techniques, which I will do, of the bodhisattva practices, there's all these many, many techniques. In the bodhisattva practices, what you're trying to do is continue to do the job you've done in the wisdom wing, which is rip out the delusions. But in the wisdom wing, you're kind of like playing safe. You back away from sentient beings. You don't kill them. You don't lie. You don't steal. You leave them alone. You leave them alone because you're driven by your delusion. So you back off, play safe, and don't harm them. Meanwhile, you work on your body, you work on your speech, and you work on your mind. It's really the retreat mode. And this is where you get your own realizations. You get together, you get renunciation, you become an amazing person. Now you're kind of qualified. You can get into the compassion wing, where now you continue working on your mind, ripping out the delusions. But now your reference point is sentient beings. You know, and now you're continuing to get rid of delusions and attachment and self-cherishing in order to benefit sentient beings. So all the meditations are related to sentient beings, you know. Here, it's all about your own delusions, your own mind, be careful, you know, blah, blah, blah. There, it's more radical, it's more amazing and more brave because sentient beings are the grist for your mill. So that, you know, all these stages of development which we'll go through. So here we get to a certain point where you do the key technique that they use to cultivate this amazing state of mind called bodhicitta is this practice they call tonglen, which people know is quite common, you know, and it means in Tibetan giving-taking, pretty simple. And it's a meditation technique, and we'll go into it in more detail in a minute, where you're learning eventually to do what they do. It's called exchanging self for others. It's this really radical practice of ripping out ego grasping and delusions, or self-cherishing as they call it, and literally making this paradigm shift in your mind where eventually, when you've experienced it, when you've realized it permanently, solidly, others are actually more important. And then this is what then gives rise to bodhicitta. And this comes on the back of great compassion, love, and all the other qualities, all the way down to equanimity, which is the foundation practice. And they're usually described in terms of 11 little development, a series of practices, 11 of them, and I'll go into these in a minute. Okay, so now we've got Harry. And Harry's walking up the mountain, and Harry sees these four Sherpas, and then he says, okay, four of them, one of me. Well, we look immediately into all these practices, and we're going to know from the teachings that there's a certain period where you're using all this logic to argue with ego's instinctive view that puts me first. So we can deduce from this, he must have done these practices, and he must have realized the exchanging self for others, because the millisecond he sees four Sherpas, and hey, honey, they're not his children. I remember Lama Zopa being very, when somebody was very impressed by some mummy in the tsunami, who went back into the waves for her baby, her child. And Lama Zopa said, amazing. But he said, it would be really amazing if she went back in for strangers. So there's Harry, four Sherpas, strangers. And he sees them, and his first thought, no drama, and he must have practiced, because you couldn't have these thoughts naturally just by being there. He's obviously practiced it. Four of them, one of me. So he put himself on the dangerous edge of the mountain to allow them to pass. And it's also intense, it's also quick. He then said, if they knock me, I won't hold on. Now that's insane. Think about it. Most people with instinct for survival, and we think this is a natural thing in all beings, that's a great term Buddha would have liked for the main delusion called ego grasping. Believe me. The instinctive protection of me as opposed to you. And so, you know, the normal person would stand up against the cliff, and if all the poor Sherpas fell off, well, it's not my fault, is it? I can't help it. No, he put himself there to protect them. And then he said, if they knock me, I won't hold on. So somehow they knocked him. It was also quick. And he said, he was falling, and he told me exactly. His feet are on the ground, the pack on his big pack is pulling him. And he said, I had a psychic vision of the entire fall. I saw my body crash to the ground. So he's being pulled by his bag. And then he said, he felt the hands of Geshe Lama Khontrog forcefully push him, and he reversed direction and fell into the Sherpas, you know. So, oh, it's an interesting story, isn't it? So where were you in the question? What was your question? What was your question?
The question was, are we prepared to...
Oh, give our life. Okay,
yeah.
There's the answer. So if you weren't prepared, if you hadn't done that work, if you hadn't gotten rid of self-cherishing, if you hadn't understood attachment, if you hadn't controlled the ego, if you didn't realize emptiness, I think that would not have occurred. Would you agree? You would have just sat there and freaked out and had a complete panic attack and hope they all don't fall off. Or if you did fall off, you'd die screaming to your death with total nightmare. That would be normal behavior, as we call it. Wouldn't you agree? So Harry was prepared to give his life for others, but he was qualified. He'd done the work. And then look what happened, the bonus, the holy beings who are capable of this. He had so much merit. That bodhicitta at that point was so stupendous. It created the cause for him to be saved in what we would call a miracle, you know. But in fact, it's not a miracle. It's the result of virtuous karma. So it's more than what you asked, but there's the answer. Does that make sense? So Buddha says we're all capable of this, but you obviously don't do it if you're not ready. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Otherwise, if you're not ready,
you'd freak out, wouldn't you? You'd have panic attack and get angry and ego would rise and you'd just...
If you're not
nightmare.
Ready, you are a victim.
Well, if you're not ready, you are a victim, precisely. Precisely, darling, yeah, that's exactly right. Exactly. There's this other wonderful story. I remember Curtis Sanchar Rinpoche, this one lama, sitting on the throne, and he said, I'll never forget the words, he said, for a certain level of bodhisattva, whatever level they've achieved, you know, he said, for that person, cutting off their hand and feeding a starving animal, that action is as inconsequential as a leaf falling off a tree. So even that seems insane to us. And insane to us from which perspective? From the normal perspective of ordinary Western psychology that assumes we didn't ask to get born, that assumes we're physical, that assumes instinct for survival is normal, and all of our sciences is reinforcing that view. And then assuming, of course, that all these delusions are natural. So Buddha's view is really quite radical. He questions every one of these, and he says it's just plain nonsense, you know, that they're all unnatural, they're all delusional, and they're the cause of all suffering, and they're not, and that they're not at the core of our being, and we can rid our mind of them. So yes, the answer is absolutely, of course you can, but you better not do it before you're ahead of your time. It's like you can't, if you're not ready to give your hand for an animal, excuse me, don't be ridiculous. When you're screaming in agony and freaking out, that's not beneficial, it's stupid. And so the point, too, of giving your hand and it's being inconsequential as a leaf falling off a tree is not just compassion. It has to be also in the context of wisdom. You'd have to deduce that there'd be no grasping of the eye there. Because even if you've got bodhicitta and compassion, that's really low level until you realize emptiness. That's why you've got to have both wings. Just to realize emptiness. Okay, just to realize emptiness without bodhicitta, that's the Hinayana path, which is amazing. You become a Hinayana arhant, an enemy destroyer, but your goal, life after life after life after life, is I must get the hell out of samsara, renunciation. That's your goal, that's your aim, that's your motivation. So when you, and that is driving you from life to life, the renunciation of samsara. And anyway, interestingly, which you must have learned from Glenn in Dharamsala, the Hinayana teachings actually say that the vast majority of sentient beings only have the capacity for this, not for becoming a Buddha. Whereas the Mahayana would say every sentient being has the potential to be a Buddha. So they have very different teachings in the Buddhist tradition, okay? So when the motivation is renunciation, it's pretty amazing. You become an extraordinary being. You give up delusions, you're very blissful, you're radiant, you're loving, you're kind, you're compassionate. But your motivation at the time of death and your bliss, which is natural, because you've rid the mind of delusions, they override any compassion you have. And that causes you to zap off into bliss for a few eons. And then they say Buddha comes along and taps you on the shoulder and says, okay, baby, now time to get out of that bliss and come onto the Mahayana path and become a Buddha so you can benefit sentient beings. So if you're on the Mahayana path, the Bodhisattva wing, you're doing all these first stages, you've got to, but you're also adding to it this one of bodhicitta. This becomes your reason, becomes your motivation. Not just renunciation, I've got to get out of samsara, but oh my God, everybody's in samsara, and if I don't help them, who will? So it's a much bigger motivation, a more courageous one. They talk about bodhisattva warriors, the courage to want to never give up, becoming a Buddha because the suffering of sentient beings is unbearable. All sentient beings. And we'll go through the stages after we have a cup of tea. We'll go through from equanimity up just to show the little stages you go through incrementally that culminate in bodhicitta. So if you're on the Mahayana path, you're going through the same stages, junior school and high school, but your motivation is more expansive. It isn't just renunciation. You've also got the motivation of I must become a Buddha to benefit sentient beings. Now that is bodhicitta, and then that comes from what they call great compassion. And that's the unique characteristic of the compassion of the bodhisattva. So compassion, that Hinayana arhat, of course they have compassion and love. The essential two main qualities of all the compassion wing, you could say they're love and compassion, and they even come down to the one, compassion. All the good qualities you can say are in there, you know. So all these stages, the 11 little techniques, starting with equanimity, kind of culminate in the accomplishment of bodhicitta. That comes as a result of great compassion, and great love, if you like. And then that comes as a result of compassion, which comes as a result of the other techniques to come down to equanimity, and I'll describe. So, okay, what's this great compassion, this unique compassion of the bodhisattva? Well, compassion is, as I said, a thought. Bare bones, it's a thought, but you grow it to a limitless degree where it becomes completely experiential, completely like emotion, totally perfect. This is when you see suffering, you find it unbearable. That's called empathy with the suffering of others. That's compassion. What's love? Love is you see happiness and you delight in it, or you want sentient beings to be happy. That's love and compassion. And they're like come together, sometimes one before the other, depending on the person, you know. So love is the wish to make others happy. Compassion is the wish that they don't suffer. Now, let's add another level to this, and this is the level of the bodhisattva's compassion. And this is the one they call great compassion. Even you could say great love. So what's great compassion? So you see suffering. You see a person with a headache. oh my God, that's terrible, that's suffering, I'm so sorry. But then you add this other piece, and this is the one, we mentioned it briefly yesterday, the unique one. You say, what can I do to help? That's the great compassion. It's the one where the bodhisattva says, it's my job. If I don't do it, who will? And this you cultivate. It's my job. Not in the neurotic way. We think now it's my job. We run around being all attached and neurotic and then becoming a victim. Victims think that way. That's not like this at all. It's a really courageous attitude. And this is massive. I mean, to even get to this where it's real is so high. But we've got to start somewhere with a thought, you know? Great compassion. And then, why was I saying all this? I was going in one direction. Great compassion. Making the point that great compassion is this unique characteristic of the bodhisattva's compassion. The Hinayana level has compassion, of course, but there's not the great compassion. So for the Hinayana, you've accomplished, you've realized emptiness, you've perfected it in that life, you've got renunciation, you're amazing, you're blissful, you're clear, there's love, there's compassion in your mind, delusions are gone, you're blissful. But like I said, your motivation for life after life is I've got to get out of samsara, and the bliss you experience, by the time you die, that overrides your compassion. Whereas the bodhisattva, same level of realizations, let's say, but at the time of their death, their great compassion, it's my job, I must do it, that overrides any bliss. And they immediately, even if they don't need to, take another rebirth for the sake of sentient beings. That's the unique one of the bodhisattva. So why don't you have a cup of tea, and then we can finish with the bodhisattva path, and then we'll finish the Tara meditation. Okay? It's 20 to 4. We've got time. See you in 20 minutes, I mean. I don't know, whatever you like. Thank you.